Hello, and welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. This week, as many kids and adults attempt to successfully navigate school drop-offs and afternoon pickups, we are working to develop a routine. But with the school year may come a range of emotions and challenges, academic pressures, peer pressure, body image and self-esteem issues, performance anxiety, and bullying are just a few of these challenges. It's a staggering fact that in the United States, approximately 20% of adolescents experience mental health disorders, according to the National Institute of Mental Health. The Institute has also established that many of these disorders have their onset around the age of 14, making early detection and intervention vital for ensuring a healthier future. Today, we will explore the most common mental health disorders that affect adolescents, the crucial evaluations that help identify these issues, and the diverse range of treatments that can make a positive impact on their lives. Our experts aim to empower us with the knowledge we need to support young minds navigating today's challenges. Joining us today is Mr. Joshua Arvidson, who serves as the Chief Operating Officer at Alaska Behavioral Health. He is a licensed clinical social worker and expert in trauma-informed care. Also joining us is Ms. Kristen Mortensen. She has a master's degree in clinical psychology and is the clinical director at Alaska Behavioral Health and the director of the Alaska Child Trauma Center. Mr. Arvidson and Ms. Mortensen, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Good morning. And you can also join our conversation. Have you noticed any changes in your child as they prepared to go back to school? Are there specific challenges your adolescent may be facing this school year that you'd like our experts to shed light on? Call us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752, 1-888-353-5752, in Anchorage at 907-550-8433, or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. So, Mr. Arvidson, last time you were here with us, you shed light on the substance abuse issue that's facing our adolescents, and we learned so much from that. So I was really looking forward to this more general conversation today about mental health issues facing our youth. Can you just reintroduce yourself to us?
Yeah, my name is Joshua Arvidson. I'm a lifelong Alaskan, and I've been in the mental health field for 25 years and a therapist for 20 years. And I work at Alaska Behavioral Health, where I work with a team of folks who serve children, adolescents, and adults. So very glad to be here.
Thank you. And Ms. Mortensen, I know you've been on the show before, but this is our first time talking. So I'm happy that you could be here to join us and share your perspective. What inspired you to become a counselor and to work with children and families specifically?
Yeah, so for me, it started, I just wanted to understand what makes people tick and why people do the things that they do. And as I began to enter the field of psychology, I became more interested in what helps people be resilient when they face life stressors, which helps us understand how to treat adversity and people who are negatively impacted by adversity.
Thank you. And I saw that you are an ARC trainer. What is this? You're a nationally certified ARC trainer.
Yeah. So ARC is the fundamental treatment framework that we use at our center. And it's a way of thinking and understanding how children and families have been impacted by stress. It's a treatment framework that has evidence that supports its efficacy. But it's also an organizational framework that educators, physicians, any child serving system can really utilize to support kids who've experienced trauma. So it has kind of three components. We think about adults and how we can support adults in responding to children, how we can help kids regulate their bodies and be safe in their bodies, and then how we can get them back on track developmentally.
Okay. And so are you training the therapists, the counselors, the educators, all of these groups, or do you specialize in one specific group?
Yeah, so we train anyone who's interested in intervening with kids who've experienced trauma, primarily clinicians and therapists at our center. They're all trained in the model, but we train people across the state and across the country.
Okay. Well, let's dive into adolescent mental health. What are some of the typical challenges and struggles that adolescents face today?
Yeah, so adolescents face a lot of the same challenges that we as adults face, but they face it during a time of rapid development. And if you think about, you know, as you enter adolescence, at the age of 10, you're maybe an elementary school student. And then 10 years later, you know, you're maybe in college, join the military, maybe even starting your own family. That's a lot to handle in a decade of life.
So fast.
Yeah, so fast. And so adolescents are you know, facing the same challenges that all of us face in life, but they're facing it during a time of rapid development. So what we see in data is that the most common things that adolescents struggle with from a mental health perspective are anxiety, depression, and traumatic stress. You know, really similar things to what adults experience, but they experience it during a really rapid time of development. And so they have some special vulnerabilities, but also some special resiliences.
When you talk about traumatic stress, what are some of these stressors that are leading to this? Are they the same things that, you know, adults may, well, obviously they're not the same as what brings on like traumatic stress or post-traumatic stress in adults. So what are some of the differences between this disorder in adults and children?
Yeah, so for children and youth, typically they're experiencing violence. Oftentimes it's violence in their homes, but also violence in the community could be impacting their mental health and well-being. We also see other types of traumas. You know, trauma is a general word that's kind of used and thrown out, but it's really an experience that overwhelms the capacity of an individual to cope. So it might be a separation from a caregiver, the loss of a caregiver that might be influencing their mental health and well-being and lead to the need for some mental health intervention.
You know, when it comes to loss in our lives, we all experience loss in some way, but we express what we're experiencing differently. Are you seeing different expressions in children when they are dealing with loss than you would in adults?
Yeah, I think that can happen. Oftentimes for kids, we'll see the loss of developmental competencies, so things that they used to be able to do quite well. Maybe they can't do those things anymore and maybe lose those abilities. We often see kids who will return to what we call a secure base when they experience stress, so a relationship that they find comforting. I think we all do that as human beings, but we see that particularly strong with kids. So what that might look like is they might not want to go to school. They want to stay home because home and the people at home are safe and they feel supported in that setting. So the behaviors can look very different, but it often is an attempt that the child or the youth might have to regulate and manage those responses and experiences that they're struggling with.
And I think in our earlier discussions, you had discussed with me that loss is not necessarily loss of life that they may be experiencing. Loss can come in different forms.
Absolutely. Kids experience loss in some pretty profound ways because they just understand and experience the world in a little bit different way. So extended separations for children can be from their caregivers can be really stressful, and can feel permanent even when they're not. So kids experience the world in a much more immediate way than we do as adults, and so extended separations from caregivers. Loss of the availability of their caregivers, disruptions in schooling, those sorts of things can really be experienced with kids in a big way.
And I think that when we as adults are trying to keep things from our children, you know, you're trying to deal with things with the other adults in your life and may not share all of the intimate details of things with kids because you think they can't handle them. But I would imagine at some point when you mentioned the separation may not be permanent, those are things that the child may not know because we're not sharing intimate details with them about whatever may be going on in their life. Well, are there any early warning signs that parents and caregivers should look out for indicating that an adolescent might be experiencing a mental health issue? And I know there's so many mental health issues, but what are some of these warning signs when we have to dig deeper?
Yeah, so I think one of the best things that parents and caregivers could watch out for is a change, an abrupt or maybe a change that's been building over time, and it might be a change in mood. It might be a change in the peer group. It might be a change in their activities that they're engaging in. So they maybe enjoyed band or orchestra and then have stopped engaging in that activity very abruptly. It may be a change in how they're doing physically. So with adolescents and with kids, we often see more more somatic complaints, like the tummy aches, gastrointestinal problems, headaches that are always present and just don't go away and don't have a medical cause. But overall, what you're looking for is some sort of change in your child that there's not like a very simple explanation for. It could be change in grades, peer relationships, those types of things. But one of those abrupt changes are things that are oftentimes warning signs that you might want to dig a little bit deeper to see what's happening for a youth.
Yeah, and I think Kristen mentioned earlier that one of the things we look for when kids experience stressors is, you know, what we call developmental regression. So they kind of go backwards a little bit. And so that's one of those specific changes you can look for. You know, you have a child who's maybe, you know, able to independently do something, and then they sort of, you know, go backwards a little bit. That's often a sign that a child is going through significant stressors and may need some extra attention and assistance. So that might be one of those specific changes. The other thing that we look at is a social withdrawal and kind of disengagement. Whether that's from their parent or their family or their peer group is often also a sign that an adolescent is going through something particularly stressful and maybe needs additional support.
You bring up so many interesting nuggets of information. One of them I've heard from, you know, a few different people, maybe some, you know, patients that have children that have had some illnesses they haven't been able to identify, and you think that this illness it's really physical, you know, like nausea and vomiting or stomach pain, like you said, and they've been going through huge, huge workups trying to figure out what's going on with no answers. And that everything is okay. So, you know, now maybe at this point, this is a time to advocate for an evaluation. What would be the next step in this situation when you're already, you know, working with your pediatrician and perhaps specialist, and you're not finding out what's wrong with your child who is physically ill?
And in that situation, you would suspect like a mental health condition that you'd want to look into further. You know, I always start with the pediatric provider, and most pediatric offices have a short-term counselor or social worker who can help evaluate that situation. But any parent can self-refer for an evaluation for their child at a mental health or a behavioral health care clinic to determine if there's the presence or absence of a mental health condition, and that would be through an evaluation. We collect some data from parents and from kids to look at different conditions, but then we also talk to kids and families about what their experiences are, which helps us to kind of refine and decide if there is potentially the presence of depression or anxiety or a stressor-related disorder.
So you talk to the family all together, but you also talk to the child alone?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this may be a good next step for this family. I think sometimes you just don't think, you know, that far ahead, or you don't think in that way when it comes to your children. So,
yeah, I mean, I think your question highlights something that's really interesting about children and adolescents. And that is that children, adolescents often experience emotional distress in their body. We call it psychosomatic, but it means and we talk this way even as adults, right? Like when you feel upset, you kind of feel it in your gut or you feel it in your stomach. And so it is really something that can be complicated, trying to figure out whether there's something medical going on or something emotional going on. But it is something to be really aware of, that children and adolescents in particular, they often feel their distress in their bodies. So they'll say, I just don't feel good. And sometimes that may mean they're, you know, physically sick. And sometimes that means that they're emotionally distressed. And actually, those two things aren't really all that different at a biological level, right?
That's true.
And we separate those things out, the physical and the emotional. But they're really all part of how our body and our mind work together. So it can be really complicated to figure out. But it's always something to pay attention to when your child is saying, I'm in pain or I'm distressed. Because even if it's not something physical, it really is something that's important.
Right. Well, actually, you know, it is the same in adults. It's just, you know, as adults emotionally mature, they also, you know, mature physically. And so they may not have such overt or severe physical issues. But, you know, the same, they have perhaps headaches or fatigue, you know, or a lack of interest in activities because they're fatigued. But it may not just be that simple that they're tired. And you think about the tenets of lifestyle medicine, and one of them is stress reduction, because we know that stress plays a huge role in our bodies and our longevity. So it makes sense to make sure our children are mentally healthy from a young age to increase their longevity. And it's not just increasing lifespan, but your healthy lifespan.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Well, the other thing you mentioned was them being interested or abruptly stopping activities. And that can be a difficult thing depending on the age, because some of the children, they're just, oh, I don't want to do that anymore. Or maybe they're not, they don't feel like they're good at something. And so then they switch. So how do we make that, you know, that determination that they're just wanting to try new things versus there's an issue?
Yeah. I think one of the things I look for is, are they engaging in other activities as alternatives to the thing they once loved? So it makes sense in childhood and adolescence. You're going to try out different things. It's a time of exploring your identity and who you are and your preferences. So that's a wonderful opportunity for youth. But if they drop out of things they once loved, or oftentimes you'll hear youth describe, I just don't experience joy. I don't enjoy doing the things I used to. That's different than ending something because you decided to do something different. So I think you can kind of differentiate those two things. And is there a substitute activity that's meeting the same need, whether it's a need for social connection? That's a lot of why kids do sports and different activities, whether it's a need for feeling competent and successful. That often meets that type of need. Are they substituting another activity in replacement for the thing they've decided to change? So it's not just that they're changing, but it's also that, like, they didn't experience any pleasure from doing that activity anymore, and there's nothing else kind of taking its place that's meeting the need.
That makes sense. That makes sense. So when you talk about activities, so there are, you know, differences of opinions of whether your child should be scheduled or be free to be, you know, at home. But, you know, today at home may not be the safest environment. We'll get into a little bit of the social media piece. But how do we know when it is, when our child is over scheduled? I'm definitely an activity person. Like, we need to have activities. But who knows? Maybe it's too much. How do you know if you go too far?
Oh, that's a difficult one. I would never put myself out there to be a parenting expert at all. There's no right way to parent. And I've never met a parent who does it right all the time. Right. So I think part of it is tuning into what's best for your child and what helps them function optimally. I think everybody needs unstructured time in their lives to play. And my daughter describes it as her chill time. And that's great. We all need that time that's unstructured. But each child is different in terms of, like, the amount of input they can take in, the amount of social interactions that's best for them, the energy that they have. But, you know, parents can kind of tune into when it's too much and there's the need for maybe a little bit less structured time in their lives and in their days. But there's so many opportunities for kids. As a parent, you want to provide everything that's available.
Yeah, and I think as Kristen said, you know, different, you know, different families have different cultures around how much they want to structure their time and how much wants to be scheduled. But underneath that, like, desire to structure activities or schedule activities, whether it's scheduled or unscheduled, we want to provide youth lots of opportunities to develop competencies, to find things that they enjoy, to develop social connection, and that includes with us. And so for some families, that may be more informal, like we all kind of get together and plan out a meal and go to the grocery store. And that would be like maybe an unscheduled, but a meaningful activity. And then some families lean more towards, you know, let's schedule this event together and this event and this. And I don't think it matters too much. Each family and each has their own culture around that and preferences around that. But underneath that, you know, we're trying to provide opportunities for young people to explore, to find things that they enjoy. And to connect with us and our family and their peers. And so as long as those things are being accomplished, whether you schedule it all out or you do it a little bit more just as it goes, I think it's fine.
Thank you. That's good guidance from both of you. And that brings me to communication. So communication can be challenging between parents and adolescents, especially as adolescents are trying to become more independent. And also, they may be at that stage where they just give one-word answers. So how do we communicate effectively with them? Especially, I know you had discussed the importance of broaching the subject of mental health with them. How do we do that when we're having difficulties communicating in the way they need?
Yeah. So I've got a couple of thoughts around that. And most of this has come from what I've learned from clients along the way and parents I've worked with. One is looking for opportunities to communicate. Rarely does it happen when you plan the conversation with your child. It often happens when the child's in a place of readiness. So watching for those opportunities and being open, accessible, and available during those opportunities. For a lot of parents, it's happening in a car ride when they maybe traffic is bad and it's not the best time for them, but that's when their child wants to talk. So let's use that opportunity. Or it happens at nighttime as they're saying goodnight and there's some relaxation that's happened as part of the day. So timing, I think, is one of it. It's not often when we're ready. It's when kids are ready to actually be open to talking. The other piece that, you know, I work with a lot of parents on is asking open-ended rather than closed questions. So leaning in more to the how and why questions rather than the who, what, where, when. Like, give me the data, but that does always elicit. If you ask, you know, a yes or no question, you get a yes or no response from youth. So really leaning in more to the, well, tell me about why that happened, or how did you make that decision? You know, those types of questions can elicit more back and forth and reciprocal communication with kids.
Are we waiting for them to start a discussion with us about something and then we're diving in deeper by asking those questions?
Well, I encourage parents to invite the conversation, because if we don't ask and we don't open the door, kids will assume, and this happens with therapists and their clients as well, well, you're not ready to talk about it, Mom, because you didn't ask me about it. So I think it's appropriate to dive into those conversations and introduce the idea. And sometimes kids need to kind of process that a little bit, and they'll come back to it later in the week, later in the day. But so you're communicating to them that you're open and available to talk about whatever topic it is you're wanting to talk about, whether it's mental health or stressors they're having at school.
What if we're not, you know, exactly concerned that there may be an issue or there's not an issue that has come up, but we just want to talk? What are some example questions that we can ask to open up the communication line so we can hear more about their mental health or perhaps learn more about it?
Yeah, one technique that we use as therapists a lot, we call like displacement, which would be, you know, you could talk about if you're watching a show, what do you think is going on for those characters? Why do you think this person reacted in this big way? It kind of takes the attention off of the adolescent, which is really reassuring for adolescents, you know, who are really self-conscious. And it opens that conversation in a way that's really neutral to them, but sends a message that you are thinking about how people think and what they feel, and you're curious as to what they think about how people think and they feel. And it's really engaging your adolescent. Yeah, you're their parent, but they're becoming an adult, and they have a mind that has all kinds of capabilities, and adolescents love it when you talk to them in that way, that you kind of engage them as a really thinking, curious human being. And so that would be just one example and technique that we use in clinical practice. But
I like that.
Yeah, thinking about what Josh said, which really resonates with me, is they're also very tuned in to movies, music. I mean, just asking them about, what do you think that song means that we just listened to on the radio, and tell me about what you think the meaning of, why is this a meaningful song to you? So that can be another way to kind of invite in communication with your child.
I'm going to have to do a lot more research, because I think they know so much more about music and movies and things than we do. So it'll be a good opportunity for them to, you know, teach us what's going on. Well, we need to take a short break, and then we're going to come back and continue this conversation. You are listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. If you have a question or comment for our guests today, give us a call statewide at 1-888-353-5752, 1-888-353-5752, or in Anchorage at 550-8433. After this short break, we will continue our discussion on mental health challenges affecting our youth with Mr. Joshua Arvidson and Ms. Kristen Mortensen as Line 1 continues statewide.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line 1 on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Alaska needs more quality, licensed childcare providers. If you're interested in starting a childcare business, connect with ThreadAlaska.org for support and guidance. There are several resources to get licensed and launched in Alaska. A licensed facility opens doors and opportunities for the business owner and creates a safer, more engaged place for children. You can make a lasting difference in the lives of children and their families. This message sponsored by Thread.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. I'm joined by guest, Mr. Joshua Arvidson, a licensed clinical social worker who has worked in behavioral health for 25 years and currently serves as the chief operating officer at Alaska Behavioral Health. Also joining us is Ms. Kristen Mortensen. She is a counselor who partners with children and families to help them meet their goals to improve their mental health and well-being. She is a lifelong Alaskan who embraces the joys and challenges of parenting. Has your child experienced behavior problems and mood changes? Are you concerned about performance or social anxiety now that your kids are back to school? Call us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752, in Anchorage at 907-550-8433, or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. So I want to move more into some of the common disorders that you spoke about. And one of them is anxiety and stress, and that this tends to be more prevalent among adolescents with mental health issues. What are the different types of anxiety experienced by adolescents?
Yeah, so there can be generalized anxiety, and that's when you are just kind of anxious across multiple circumstances and situations. And there can also be social anxiety, which is really more focused on anxiety around social situations, peer situations, those sorts of things. We also see in adolescents some of what we call performance anxiety, which is, you know, really getting stressed out about, like, if I get an A minus on this test, it's going to be a disaster. And adolescents can put a lot of pressure on themselves around performance. So those are three kind of types of anxiety that we see in our clinical practice a lot. And each of those, you know, presents in a little bit of a different way and is a little bit different in terms of how we intervene.
Yeah, and anxiety is that kind of a youth's kind of subjective experience of worry about things, multiple things, or one particular item that they're worried about or part of their life. But it's also like associated behaviors and physiological symptoms that go along with the worry. So there might be a panic attack or a panic disorder associated with that anxiety where they, you know, their heart races and they get really hot and they don't feel like they have control over their bodies. And usually the behavioral adaptations to that anxiety are, you know, trying to remove yourself from the situation, avoid situations where you may experience anxiety and maybe many types of situations where you may experience anxiety. So there's kind of some body symptoms that go along with that anxiety and that worry as well as some behavioral changes.
So is that how we distinguish it between just typical worries and something more pathologic?
Yes.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and part of that is anxiety is, and I was talking with a group of adolescents about this actually yesterday, anxiety is important as human beings. If we don't pay attention to danger, we're in trouble. And so I think it's really important to identify that some anxiety and nervousness about new situations is actually really adaptive in human beings. It helps us be safe. It's when that anxiety becomes debilitating and we lose our functioning and it overwhelms us, then that's something we want to pay more attention to.
Well, I'm thinking about, you know, in performance anxiety or performance, when you're performing at sports and music or anything that you may do, there's those nervous jitters that you get. And I think that, you know, could be typically normal. But then at some point it may go to where you do not want to do the activity because it causes that stress in you. But is that, you know, a bad thing, that may not be a pathologic anxiety, right?
Yeah. So low levels of stress, you know, however you want to define that, actually enhances performance. So coming here today, I experienced a low level of stress and I did some deep breathing. It helped me read your questions before I walked in the door and kind of think about what I wanted to say. But when that stress becomes overwhelming and the youth doesn't have any ability to cope with it or very limited ability to cope with it, the risk is that they might engage in some maladaptive or not helpful coping strategies to cope with that stress. So we need to kind of teach some skills when we notice that that stress and that anxiety is at a level that overwhelms them.
So families and caregivers can at that point help to mitigate that response and help before it becomes true anxiety. So what are some of the ways that we can intervene and help them to use that stress to enhance their performance?
Yeah, well, I just want to start with acknowledging, because we haven't talked about it yet, is the power of modeling. Mm. So we talk a lot about teaching youth some skills, which is really important, but we also need to note if we're being good models of self-care and using positive coping strategies as adults. Kids pay attention to what we say, I hope, but they probably pay more attention to what we do. So I would just encourage us to think about, as adults who are caring for kids, you know, how are we modeling, you know, helpful ways to cope with stress? And are we making that explicit to kids? Like, talking about, boy, I was really nervous about something I had to do at work today, and I brought my water, and I took some deep breaths, and I practiced what I wanted to say, and it really helped me to feel like I was more successful. So I want to start, and Josh will have lots of tips, I'm sure, about things we can teach kids, but we should be also modeling those skills for our youth and showing them along the way what we do to take care of ourselves.
Absolutely. That really is mind-blowing. I love that. And you do think your kids, they tend to adopt the same mannerisms as you and say some of the same phrases. But yes, modeling that behavior and modeling loving yourself would be really important, so that they are an acceptance of yourself, right? That's great advice. Anything else?
That is great advice. I think
such great advice, yeah. Yes.
I think, you know, it kind of similar to that, kind of normalizing anxiety. And empathizing with your adolescent's anxiety, it is normal to be nervous about new situations and things where there's expectations placed upon us, and like Kristen said, to even be open about that in our own experiences, you know, within limits that children can tolerate, sharing situations that make us nervous, and also focusing on two successes when adolescents overcome that anxiety. Like, you were nervous about that, but, you know, you powered through it and you did such a great job, and that sense of accomplishment that adolescents get. And that could be over really small things. But kind of walking with adolescents through that kind of cycle of being nervous or anxious about something, kind of leaning on their coping strategies. And even if they're not able to go through with whatever it was, you know, the activity they withdraw, for example, just acknowledging how they coped with that, those feelings of anxiety, how they overcame them, because often we focus on the things that aren't going well, but adolescents are overcoming little situations all the time, and just reflecting on that and acknowledging that you know, they were able to do it.
So what I'm hearing from both of you is that communication and talking is important, and so all of this comes to just talking with your comes down to talking with your children and the children that are in your lives. I like that. Now, I'm thinking about expectations. You brought up expectations and, you know, academic pressures and academic stress. And many of us have very high expectations for our children. And are we adding to that stress that they may be putting on themselves? And I know that you mentioned, you know, every child is very different. So some of them may take that on more as, you know, I need to get that A+, and they are unable to cope if they get the A-. Whereas another child may be like, hey, this is great. I'm happy with this A- or B or whatever it is. So when you come to families and wanting, because I think it's really important to have expectations, but not to have such expectations that perhaps your child is adding to that stress on himself or herself.
Yeah, I think a big piece of that is, is stepping back a little bit from the outcome, like you got an A or an A minus, or you got a C or you got a D, and focusing on the process and the application, because that's what's really protective in the long run, right? Whether you get an A or an A minus on a test in eighth grade isn't going to predict your long-term outcomes, or a C, or even if you fail the test. Mm-hmm. What's going to predict long-term outcomes is, you know, can you stick with it? Can you apply yourself? Can you feel successful in making incremental progress? And so I think one of the ways we can really support adolescents is focusing more on them and the effort they put in, the enjoyment they get out of things, and less on the outcome or performance. I was having a conversation with an adolescent who, you know, had performed in a singing performance, and, you know, they want to know how they sound. And I understand that, but instead, you know, kind of what I focused a little bit more on was, you know, I bet you were nervous. Oh yeah, I was nervous. But you got up there and you did it. Yeah, I did do it. That is so amazing. And kind of stepping back a little bit from the, like, how did you sound? But like, because, you know, maybe you'll be a professional singer, maybe you won't. But what's really underneath that is, I felt nervous about this, but I powered through it and I did it, and I feel so good about that. And so I think the more we can kind of pull back from the outcome and focus on what's going on internally for that. Yeah, absolutely. That's what's protective in the long run, because that's what's going to help them stick with things and power through situations as they grow up.
I like that, congratulating them, using your words, I guess, to talk about that process and how they were successful.
Yeah.
Regardless of the outcome, I guess.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Well, moving into mood, that's a big one, to depression versus mood changes. So as kids go through puberty, they start having some mood changes, both girls and boys. Now, how do we distinguish mood changes, just your regular adolescent moodiness, from a depression?
Yeah, that's a good question. So when I think about what distinguishes depression from, you know, maybe situational shifts in mood or in response to maybe a stressor, puberty changes that might be happening, depression is kind of low mood, but then also has a lot of other associated challenges. So you might see challenges with sleep, challenges with eating, loss of hygiene in response to that depressed mood, loss of interest in activities. So there's all sorts of other things that go along. You know, all of us at some time experience low mood, like, yes, it happens. But a person who experiences clinically significant depression, that low mood is present, you know, more days than not. Mm-hmm. You might also see, like, feelings of hopelessness about the future, not wanting to think about the future, not thinking the future can be positive. There might be changes in the way adolescents think. So they think everything's their fault, or they can't do anything right, or things will never get better. So we're not just looking at those challenges in moodiness, which all of us experience, and definitely adolescents experience more so than adults, but other associated symptoms that will be going along that lead to kind of a concern about depression.
When you notice any of these things where you're noticing they are withdrawing from their peers, from their activities, and maybe physical changes, is your first stop, well, I guess the first thing should be talking to your child, right? I knew you would say that. So talking to them. And then when you need help, though, is the pediatrician your next stop?
Yeah, for most families, they have an established relationship with their pediatric provider, and that makes sense in terms of a first point of intervention. Some families already have established relationships with a behavioral health care provider, so that might make the most sense, and that person could do the evaluation. But for most families, your pediatric provider can guide you through the process and do some initial screening.
And so when it comes to the moodiness, are you saying they're just, some of my, I know this, they're moody just with a family. They may not be moody with all of their friends. So that you have to just let go and ride through? Okay. It's good to know. I think this is a question of many people. So now we know. The thought of them, you know, withdrawing from their activities or seeing these, you know, physical changes is certainly very, very scary. Are there any less subtle things that we may see before it gets to that point?
Yeah, I think in thinking about depression in adolescence, I often think of kind of two categories of manifestations. So one category are the psychological manifestations. So like hopelessness, despair, thoughts that, you know, I'm a failure, nothing's going to work out. Those are kind of like cognitive components, and those are the psychological components of depression. In adolescence, we also see a lot of physical components of depression. So that might be lethargy, big changes in appetite and sleep, just feeling drained all the time, no energy, those sorts of things. And this is where, you know, kind of going back to where we started the conversation and kind of sorting out whether there's something physical going on or something emotional going on. Those can all be kind of early signs. And like Kristen said, we kind of look for big changes and then changes that persist. So that's what separates moodiness from depression. I think of it like the weather and the climate. So mood is more like the climate. Like we had a rainy summer here, but you know, today it's sunny. That's more like the weather. So that's more like what, you know, moodiness is kind of like the weather. It changes every day, but we look for persistent changes that go on for like Kristen said, more days than not for a period of time of a couple weeks or more. That is a sign that we're looking at something more than just kind of the moodiness that happens to all of us, but particularly in adolescence.
That's a great way to distinguish. I like that analogy. You know, also, I think another thing that's very important, and you talked about social connection, I'm thinking about the child's peer group and their peer interactions, and I think it's so important to know the people that your children are hanging out with. How can the group of peers influence, well, we know many of the ways, but what are some of the ways we may not know of how peers can influence children or each other? You're both looking like it's a whole can of worms.
I think what I would say about that is that one of the biggest things in thinking about the peer groups that adolescents engage with is, you know, when children are young, maybe as parents, we have a large influence on who they spend their time with. And as they get older, they're going to self-select their peer group more and more. And when they're young adults, pretty much their friends are going to be who they want their friends to be. And so I think one of the key things in thinking about peers and peer influences is as children get older, helping them be thoughtful about who they spend their time with, who they associate with. And kind of picking up on something Kristen said earlier, that can be having conversations like instead of, you know, this, I don't think this person is a good influence or that those sorts of things. I mean, you can say those sorts of things, but what might be more helpful is how do you feel when you spend time with this person? Are they someone who picks you up or puts you down? Or, you know, what is it like? What does this person bring to your life? And what do you bring to their life? Because if you can build that awareness as adolescents get older, they're going to be the drivers of who their peer group are. And the more thoughtfulness and awareness they bring to that, the better off they'll be. And I think that's one of the really critical differences between parenting young children and adolescents is at the end of the day, adolescents, as they get older, they're going to make decisions. So it's more about helping them think about who they want to spend time with and who they think is someone that it brings value to their life.
I guess that's another opportunity to model as well, modeling your friend group and how those friends influence your life in positive ways. Mm-hmm. Well, we need to take our last break. But when we come back, we'll continue this conversation. We're going to take another short break for the stations down the line. If you have a question or comment for our guests today, give us a call statewide at 1-888-353-5752. 1-888-353-5752 or in Anchorage at 907-550-8433. We'll continue our discussion on adolescent mental health challenges when we return. You're listening to Line One, your health connection on Alaska Public Media.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line One on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Strong connections can help people thrive during tough times. Whether it's spending quality time with loved ones, finding peace in nature, or the unconditional love of furry companions, these connections help people stay present and have healthier relationships with ourselves and others. Share what makes you feel connected at ChooseConnectionAK.org. This message sponsored by the Alliance.
Thank you. Welcome back to Line One. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. Our guests today are Mr. Joshua Arvidson, the founder of Alaska Child Trauma Center and the chief operating officer at Alaska Behavioral Health, and Ms. Kristen Mortensen, a licensed professional counselor at Alaska Behavioral Health and director of early child and outpatient services. You can also join our conversation. Do you want to explore strategies for supporting your child's healthy self-perception? Are you familiar with resilience-building practices affecting positive change in our youth? Call us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752, 1-888-353-5752, in Anchorage at 907-550-8433, or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. So, Mr. Arvidson, last time you were here, we talked about substance abuse in our youth. And that same day, there was an advisory from the Surgeon General that we saw after the program. And the advisory emphasized the potential dangers of excessive social media use on adolescent mental health. And he highlighted that while there may be some benefits to social media, such as connection and information sharing, it also posed risks such as cyberbullying and unrealistic body image standards and increased feelings of anxiety and depression. So I know that you had the opportunity to speak with our Surgeon General, Dr. Vivek Murthy, when he was here. What can you share about your conversation and what did you take away from this advisory?
Yeah, so Dr. Murthy is just incredible, and what he's put out in his advisories is just really strikes me as someone who works with children and families is really, really insightful. One of the things that he shared when he was here in Alaska is that one of his thoughts about what's driving, you know, high suicide rates and other challenges in adolescence is a profound sense of loneliness. And he talked about how social media, we think of it as an opportunity to connect, but it also can contribute to feelings of loneliness in adolescents. And that was something that I had, you know, been kind of thinking about, but really didn't have the words around, and really struck me. And I thought about that more. And you know, it's an interesting thing. Sometimes being lonely and alone are not the same thing. You know, if you go for a hike in the mountains, even if you're just by yourself or with your dog, most people don't experience a lot of loneliness in that moment, even though they're by themselves. Whereas if you're in a crowded situation with a bunch of people you don't know, surrounded by strangers, and you don't feel like you have someone to connect to, even though you're not alone, you may feel lonely. And that really struck me when he talked about social media. It is an opportunity to connect, but it sometimes can be like being in a crowded subway or a crowded bus or a crowded room with a bunch of people that you're not really connecting to in a more profound level. And that can contribute to a sense of loneliness and isolation in adolescence. And that just kind of blew my mind. I've been thinking about that ever since he said that. And it really does help me understand how social media can sometimes help people connect, but also can have a very, very different impact on young people.
That is really profound and a very interesting way of understanding what he said. And I think that comes to one of the things that he recommended was having technology-free zones and maybe at the dinner table having that time where you're connecting. And I guess that would be the time for what you're both promoting, which is talking and asking those questions. One thing that I've noticed is that there's no way to know all of the different outlets that are out there. And if you take away or restrict one, these children are very smart and technologically savvy and will just find another outlet. So there's no way to be on top of everything that's out there. What are some of the different, I don't know if they're restrictions or guidelines, I guess, to teach your child how to use social media in a more healthy way?
Yeah, I think part of it is parents being aware of social media apps that their kids are utilizing. There are ways to monitor that usage, but it's time consuming as a parent to be able to do that. But I think there's structures you can put in place around when screen time happens, like we can turn off phones at bedtime so that kids aren't up in the middle of the night. So many of the clients I see, they're not sleeping. I'll ask, what are you doing in the middle of the night? They're on their phones, which doesn't help promote sleep at all, and it keeps your brain awake. So I think there's structures we can put in place to have, you know, screen-free zones, and then screen-free times is important for kids too. So there's times of day where they're not accessing it. And then during the day, what can we do to fill some of that time with other activities that do promote, like Josh said, that social connection need? Because oftentimes when you talk with youth about how they feel after getting off social media, they don't feel good. They don't feel like their bucket and their cup is filled up. They don't have that sense of belonging, which is likely what they're seeking by accessing social media. Other things I think you can do as parents is let's look at the social media together. You know, we're going to pull YouTube up, and you want to see funny videos of dogs or cats. I mean, half the time kids are looking at pictures of animals. Let's watch that together as a family so we can share. There are ways to kind of share some of what's happening on social media with youth. Show me your favorite, you know, TikTok video. Let's watch this together. So being part of some of that experience, I think, can be helpful as ways to connect around their interests.
Because we're all looking for that connection. And I guess what Dr. Murthy is saying is that this social media is not the best place to find the connection, and really promoting real in-life, in-person connection, especially now that we can, is probably pretty important. But it doesn't have to be structured activity, right? It could be unstructured activity, but just getting together with family and with other people. I think that's good advice for us. How, you know, you talked about resilience in our children and building that resilience. What are some other ways that we can help as a family or community to build resilience in our young people?
Yeah, so one of the things we didn't talk about earlier, which I think about in my clinical practice, is a place I often start with families, and it's the idea of building routines. So routines do a couple of things for all of us. They help create some predictability in our lives. They help us learn new skills and generalize those skills to different environments and different settings. So oftentimes when I'm just starting to work with a youth, we'll just start talking about routines and routines that can help support them in getting their needs met. So family routines might be important, helping youth create like healthy routines that help to meet their needs around times of stress, like, you know, a bedtime routine, a hygiene routine, you know, what happens after school, wherever that, you know, the moment of the day that you want to kind of help to support your child in might be a good place to start. We didn't kind of talk about that earlier, so I wanted to mention just the importance of those routines, which there's not a right or wrong routine, but it's really up to each individual family to determine, you know, how they want to utilize that skill.
Now, are you helping the individual youth to develop their own routine, or is it the family developing the routine for them?
Yeah, so it depends on what you're trying to target. But with adolescents, you really want to give as much choice as possible, right? So they have to kind of like buy into this idea. So keeping it simple is important, and having it be driven by the child is often helps to be more successful. So do you want to do your homework, you know, right when you come home after school, or do you need a little break before you do them? Like, what's going to be our after school routine that's really going to be best and optimum for you? But choice whenever possible with kids is going to help us to be more successful.
What are some of the common challenges to helping our children develop resilience?
Yeah.
And then how can we address those?
Yeah, I mean, I think social media is one, which we've talked about. It one of the concerns I have about, and Kristen really addressed this really well, which is that in adolescence and throughout childhood, parents often can serve as sort of buffers for children. We buffer their experience. So when you know, the way media used to work, you know, when it was television or radio based, often you were in the room with your young person when they saw something or heard something that might be distressing. And parents can serve such a buffering role in that experience, explaining what's going on, talking about it, putting it into context. And I think one of the challenges today is because social media is something you can digest on your own through a screen. Your parent may be in the room, but they're not able to provide that buffering that was more accessible through older types of media, if that makes sense. So as both of us are trauma therapists, one of the things that we see is that when families go through adverse experiences, when children are really able to connect with their parents throughout those experiences, whether that's even extreme experiences like being a refugee or experiencing a conflict, a war, or something like that, mm-hmm. children who have proximity to their parents really are buffered in those experiences. So that's part of why I'm concerned about social media, is that it can be consumed in isolation from the parent. And so that buffering that the parent can provide isn't there. And then another part of that that it's a little bit concerning for me is, in terms of resilience, is that it used to be your adolescent went out into the world and they were exposed to the things that they see at school. And let's say there's someone who's bullying them at their school. Bullying is horrible. In, you know, 15 years ago, when you went home, they didn't follow you mm-hmm. home. And with social media, they're there, unless you do some of the practices Kristen was saying around, you know, limiting screen time or setting up sort of kind of social media free times and zones in your home routines. Those social pressures can follow the adolescent mm-hmm. right throughout their whole 24-hour cycle. So mm-hmm. those are some of the concerns that I have that really I think do interface with how resilience works in adolescents.
Yeah. And I think what, as you asked that question, one of the things I was stuck on were kind of making the assumption that all youth have a caregiver at home that can be that buffer. And for many of the youth in our community, they don't have an available caregiver. So they're kind of trying to do this on their own. Their caregiver may be absent, maybe struggling with their own mental health challenges, substance use, et cetera. So oftentimes our youth don't have the fundamental thing they need in order to be resilient, which is the availability of a person to help alleviate some of that challenge. So I was stuck with the question because I was like, yes. Oh, many of our most impacted youth are the youth that just don't have that as a resource. The good news is it doesn't have to be a parent. It can be any safe adult. So an educator is often that person for a student, a family member, an adult friend can substitute for that caregiver. But oftentimes that's the piece that's missing.
So that may be another program, is talking about how the whole community and teachers and educators can influence resilience in our youth that may not have that at home, and even those that do but may not have parents that are modeling the behaviors mm-hmm. that we want to see. Well, we are going to be about out of time today. Do you have any final thoughts? I think that you shared so much.
I would just kind of pick up on what Kristen said, which is that whether we're parents or community members, mm-hmm. the small things that we do, just acknowledging adolescents, spending time with them, just saying hi and smiling to an adolescent who's walking past you on the bike path, mm-hmm. those little things have an impact because adolescents are just taking in all these things from the world. And so all of us have opportunities every day to just be in some way a contributor to that resilience in children in our community. And I guess that's what I'd like to share, just a word of encouragement to be that person, even in small ways.
Well said. Thank you.
We're all playing a role in their developing minds. And what did they say? The brains don't develop fully until, 23, 24 mm-hmm. years old. So imagine the impact that we can have in our children and youth. Well, thank you so much to our guests, Ms. Kristen Mortensen and Mr. Joshua Arvidsson, for being with us today. Thanks to our audio engineer, Chris Hyde, and our producer, Madeline Rose. You can find more information on this and previous programs on our website at alaskapublic.org. Let us know your thoughts and suggestions by emailing us at line1@alaskapublic.org. This has been Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. Thank you.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.